Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Huh? A mini black hole. Oh, no. I gotta take it away before more clueless kids fall into it.
Okay, so aside from my unofficial edict that anytime you can start a segment with The Simpsons, you should, there is an actual reason why we wanted to have Lisa Simpson's help introducing this next conversation about black holes.
That's because if The Simpsons have talked about a scientific concept, you know the idea is firmly embedded in our culture.
And such is the case for black holes, those most bizarre and mysterious of celestial objects. But it wasn't always the case. In fact, for decades, many scientists outright dismissed black holes, saying the idea was too preposterous to even consider.
But that changed dramatically. Now black holes may be one among the most important objects in the universe.
Which is why MIT science writer Marcia Bartuszak says her latest book isn't so much an astrophysical exploration, but rather the history of an idea. The book is Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. And Marcia Bartuszak joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So listeners, if you've got a question about black holes, about their discovery, how we explore them, what you think about them as celestial objects, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Marcia, I just wanted to first of all start with the idea of all the different ways that scientists themselves have described black holes. I mean, you begin your book with Kip Thorne from Caltech, who likens them to unicorns and gargoyles. And another scientist later also calls them the most perfect macroscopic objects in the universe. And yet another one says they're like a work of art, or said, I should say, they're like a work of art best admired from a distance. So this huge variety over time of how we have looked upon black holes. Can you just briefly describe to me, why? Why is it that this one idea has gone through so many iterations in science?
Because it's so absurd to even think about the possibility that something could collapse, something that is several solar masses could collapse to a point and then put around itself this boundary that if you enter, you cannot get out again, which is why it's called the black hole, based on the black hole of Calcutta. Mm. Once you come in, you cannot get out. It is a very strange creature, the most bizarre celestial creature, I would say, in the entire universe. But yes, it was called many things: collapsar, dark star, black star. It was hard for scientists to get their heads around this idea. It took decades to get past those psychological barriers that a star could act like this.
Right. And I mean, even perhaps the most famous scientist ever, Albert Einstein, couldn't get his head around that, which is quite ironic given how important black holes are to having approved his theories. But we'll get to that in a second, because what I wanted to just kind of get from you right now is kind of a black holes 101. In 2015, how would we best describe what they are?
They are the ultimate death of a massive star. And what happens is the star literally runs out of fuel. A star is this balancing act. Gravity is pushing the matter in, but all of that energy being generated in the center by fusion is creating radiation that pushes back out, and the star stays beautifully stable. Mm. But with a black hole, what happens is when the star runs out of fuel, literally in a second, the core collapses to a point, and the gravity is so strong that it brings everything in and lets nothing out.
And we can't see them or observe them directly. Is that true?
If there was a calm little black hole in a forgotten part of space with no matter around it, no, it would be very difficult to find that black hole. We see them when they're near matter, And when that matter gets attracted to the black hole, it doesn't just plummet right away into the black hole. It takes a while. Like, it's often been described like traffic coming to the parking lot of a football stadium at a big game. the matter starts swirling around the hole, and it takes a while to get eaten. And as it's falling towards the hole and spiraling in, it generates great energies. And that's what we see with the various X-ray and optical and radio telescopes.
Well, I think it was a very famous series of images from Hubble, right? Where it looks like, if I'm remembering correctly, this fire hose of energy coming out of a point in space, this like beacon of what looks like light.
Yeah, it's the odd thing about black holes. They're also spinning, and that this is a terrific rotation, and they act like an electric dynamo, so that even though once you pass the event horizon, that outer boundary, you can't get out, there is a way to get energy out of a black hole. As it's spinning, it generates tremendous energies out of the poles, and they flow out along these electromagnetic channels. So they do put out like a fire hose, these huge beams out into space, greatly energetic.
And why is it that in this day and age, scientists or astrophysicists believe black holes are so very important to our understanding of the universe?
It's only within, I would say, the last decade where they are now acknowledging that there is a supermassive black hole containing the mass of millions, even billions of suns in the center of every major galaxy.
Including our own.
Including our own. Ours is about 4 million solar masses. It's a bit quiet right now, but when they're active, that's what quasars are, very active supermassive black holes in young galaxies. But now they're wondering, if there's a supermassive black hole in every galaxy, does that mean that is central to the construction of a galaxy? It may be that our very existence depends on that supermassive black hole helping a galaxy form. It's speculation right now. They're not quite sure yet what the answer is, but it makes you wonder.
Well, as we said in the beginning of the conversation here, you write in your book that this is the story, the history of an idea. And so let's go back to the first time where the idea of a thing that came to be known later as a black hole was first even posited, right? And so by a man named John Mitchell, who I have to say I had never even really heard of. Who is John Mitchell in the 18th century?
No one knows of him today, but he was one, has been described by historians as one of the most inventive scientists of the 18th century. He was a mathematician, a geologist, and also an astronomer. And he had imagined in 1786, right after our Revolutionary War, there in England, he was a scholar. He imagined, what if a star were 500 times as wide as the sun, which would stretch out past the orbit of Mars, but just as dense throughout? And using Newton's law of gravity, he figured that light would not be able to escape from the star. Like water coming up in a fountain, it would reach a certain height and come back.
And bend back down, yeah.
And we would just see this dark pinprick on the sky. So I kind of like to call it the Model T version of the black hole. And it went nowhere. It was an idea that just sort of went away, which was good because he had the wrong theory of light.
Right.
And he had the wrong theory of gravity. But it didn't regenerate until Einstein entered the scene in the 20th century with his new theory of gravity.
Well, before we leave John Mitchell in this story, I do want to read, because you write about the title of the paper or the letter that he wrote to Henry Cavendish that contained this sort of sidebar idea of a black hole, because we've got a lot of people in the research fields who listen to the show, and I want to read the title of this paper. It's called On the Means of Discovering the Distance, Magnitude, etc. of the Fixed Stars in Consequence of the Diminution of the Velocity of Their Light in case such a diminution should be found to take place in any of them, and such other data should be procured from observations as would be farther necessary for that purpose.
They don't make titles like that anymore.
No, they don't. Or maybe they do. I mean, it depends on your line of research, I guess.
And it's probably why no one paid attention to the paper.
Yeah. And I mean, what was interesting to me is that you said basically he framed this idea in a letter to Henry Cavendish because he didn't think anyone would actually take him very seriously if it didn't come through Cavendish.
Yes. He felt Cavendish at the time had more authority and it would be better accepted by his peers.
Okay. So you mentioned Einstein, and he is, of course, one of the towering figures at the center of this story. And just to remind people, I mean, one of the reasons why Einstein as a young man was interested in what then later on became to be his theories of relativity was that he basically said, hey, there's a problem here. We've got Newton's laws on one hand about gravity, and then we've got Maxwell's laws on the other hand about electromagnetism. And the two don't exactly link up the way they should. That's what got him thinking about
that. That's really, it's not often put that way, but that was the central point of Einstein going after this problem is they were the two, actually the only great theories at the time, and they didn't mesh. They didn't define space and time in the same way. And that led to all of Einstein's great revelations that indeed Newton had it wrong. There is no absolute space and time. And it led to his total reinvention of Newton's law of gravity.
You know, you write about a 16-year-old Albert Einstein asking himself a particular question. And I have to say, I love the poetry of it as much as I love the science of it, that he was asking himself, if a person could keep pace with a beam of light, what would that person see? Like, if we were literally traveling as fast as the speed of light, would we just see an electromagnetic wave frozen into place because we were traveling as fast as the wave? Was such a thing even possible? I mean, it just goes to show how his mind worked.
And according to Newton's law of gravity, yes, you should be able to catch up to it. And Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism said, no, the speed of light should be constant. And he had to find a way to make those two agree.
Right, which is where relativity comes in.
Special relativity at first, general relativity afterward, which was an extension of special relativity for all cases of motion.
And as you point out, we're at the 100th anniversary of Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Coming up in November.
So what does this all have to do with black holes then?
Well, just weeks after Einstein introduced his theory in November 1915, a German astronomer named Karl Schwarzschild got the first full solution. This made Einstein ecstatic. He thought this was a great accomplishment. But the first inkling that there could be something like a black hole came out of Schwarzschild's equations, and it flummoxed everybody.
Everybody.
Everybody. Even Einstein.
Yeah, so this is what really gets me, right? Because here we have Albert Einstein, you know, the genius of astrophysics of the 20th century, who basically, like, didn't even have the mathematics to hand when he came up with his spectacular theories. They were acts of creativity and imagination, which proved to be correct. He even thought this concept of black holes was too preposterous to believe.
Because at that time, to be fair, there were no observations. It was all
there
on paper.
There weren't any observations of what relativity could show us either.
That's true. Well, he had a few experiments there, the bending of light, an adjustment in Mercury's orbit, which you know, said that he was on the right track. But this idea, you have to remember, this was an era where the universe was serene and quiet and stars quietly burned. It's not the active universe that we know of today. No one thought the universe acted in such a preposterous way.
Yeah. So this is one of the themes which I feel kind of comes up again and again in your book. And that is that in our understanding or the evolution of our understanding of what black holes are, we come upon these sort of milestones in the history of science where someone has this burst of scientific creativity and imagination. And then our powers of observation catch up to that moment of imagination.
And that's what happened here, is Einstein literally came up, and this was his genius. He came up with a theory out of pure intuition, but it needed decades more. He was decades ahead of his time. for the experiments and observations to take place to really prove it, that these celestial objects, neutron stars, you know, that are just as big as a city, and a black hole totally collapsing and creating all these jets of energy, these are things that couldn't possibly been even imagined until they got some experimental observational evidence. And that took not until the 1960s, 1970s.
I have to say, I mean, this is going to sound full of hubris, but I don't really blame Einstein, because even as we're talking about it now in 2015, it is really, really, really difficult in the sort of, I don't know, clumsy limits of my own imagination to say honestly that I can fathom what it means for a star to collapse down to a point in space and have that the gravitational force of that densely packed piece of mass to be so great that even light can't escape it. I'm not sure I really understand what that means.
And they're not really sure as yet. They won't really know exactly what happens to that matter until they get a full theory of quantum gravity. I think that's what Einstein was railing against. Singularities in physics is a big fat sign that something is wrong here. We don't fully understand what's happening. And in fact, the dean of American General Relativity, John Wheeler, got into the program, got into looking at black holes, trying to get rid of them, because he thought the singularity, he thought he could solve it and find out what was really happening there in the center of a black hole. And all he proved to himself was black holes do exist.
So just briefly, singularity, is this another word for black holes? Should we not even be calling them black holes?
They are at the center is where all the matter goes, is called a singularity.
Okay, so after Einstein does his blanket rejection, first of all, did he ever come around to thinking differently before he died? No.
No. In fact, John Wheeler, who taught at Princeton University, and Einstein was just down the road at the Institute for Advanced Study, he would go over there and talk with Einstein about his trials in trying to get rid of the singularity. And Einstein would only say, forget it. Don't worry. It's I don't want to hear anything more about it. He just did not believe in it.
So how did we get from there to where we are now, where not only do we have the wholesale rehabilitation of ideas of black holes, but they are, you know, as we talked about earlier, they're the magical creatures in the sky that really have totally captured our imagination as perhaps the most spectacular things in the universe.
And it was all with the new technologies, new astronomical instrumentation. The biggest thing was the development of X-ray astronomy, being able to send satellites and actual telescopes to gather X-rays from the universe, which was astounding. And black holes and neutron stars are the most energetic, which means also the highest energy. They put out really high energies, and they are best seen and studied in X-rays. So that didn't happen until the 1970s, and they've only been improving and improving through the decades until now. It's one of the biggest fields in astronomy.
Now, in the title of your book, we have the Newtonians, we have Einstein, and you also mentioned Stephen Hawking. What role does he play in the story of black holes?
Well, he did place a bet with Kip Thorne. That was the gamble when they recognized what they thought was the first black hole called Cygnus X-1. Kip Thorne bet that it was a black hole. Hawking was still cautious. He was conservative. He bet against. But after 16 years, they made the bet in the mid-1970s. By 1990, Hawking cried uncle. So that's the gamble. But he also was very important in he decided to look at the black hole from the perspective of an atom, and it changed how we thought about the black hole. When you are looking at the event horizon from the atomic viewpoint, it's a turmoil of particles. And he actually concluded that black holes evaporate. Now, a stellar-sized black hole, it would take 10 to the 67 years to evaporate.
That's a lot of zeros.
That's a lot of zeros. A one with 67 zeros. It's beyond our ken.
Yeah.
But it did change people's perspective that the black hole isn't so black, as he put it, ain't so black after all. So
as we sort of move towards wrapping up this conversation, how time compresses. when we're having a good conversation on Radio Boston. I want to just go circle back to where we started, and the idea that a concept in science really has arrived when it's just even in the popular culture. So a couple examples. You know I had to bring up Star Trek. So here's a scene from Star Trek Voyager.
They may be trapped in the event horizon. Open a channel. This is Captain Catherine Janeway of the starship Voyager to the vessel near the quantum singularity. Do you need help?
Event horizon?
A singularity is a star that's collapsed in on itself. The event horizon is a very powerful energy field surrounding it.
It looks like it's being pulled in toward the singularity. We have to get it out of the event horizon.
So that's a scene from Star Trek Voyager. Everything I needed to learn, no, I learned from Star Trek, I have to say. But what are the theories about what would happen if someone actually did get, this was the high school brain bender for me. What if you did get pulled into a black hole?
Well, from the classical perspective, you would get stretched like a noodle. You would be noodleized because of the tidal forces. There would be more force on your feet than your head, and you would just be stretched out and eventually just, you would just be torn up into subatomic particles. There is a quantum view, though. This is the speculation at this point, that instead of entering this zone where you go right to the singularity, that you'll actually hit a firewall of tumultuous particles and space and time breaking up. But that's only speculation. They won't know until they get a full theory of quantum gravity.
That's true. So the human imagination continues to leap forward. The observable, measurable science will follow.
Yes.
That's what I guarantee. Well, the new book is Black Hole, How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. It's by Marcia Bartuszak. Marcia Bartuszak, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a delight.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.